So I don't know if you noticed that. There was a very strange little miracle that Jesus did. Because at first glance, it might seem that it didn't quite work, didn't it? And it is quite strange, isn't it? Because you might be able to look through the Bible, through the New Testament, and find at least 7 other times Jesus healed someone who was blind. And there could have been an awful lot more than that that aren't really mentioned or sort of mentioned in crowds. Lots of people came to Jesus and he healed them all. But we know of 7 individuals who came to Jesus who were blind, and Jesus healed each one. And he healed all of them instantly, except this one. He came to Jesus to be healed for his blindness, and Jesus led him by the hand and took him out of the crowd, to a bit of privacy, and so on. And then we'd read in those verses that Jesus spat on his eyes and put his hands on this man's eyes. And then Jesus asked him if he could see anything. Do you remember the funny phrase that Elijah just read for us? And he said, "I can see men. They look like trees. And they're walking." What a muddled statement that is. So he could see, but he could only see a bit. And then Jesus does it again. Jesus has to go back and do a second installment, a second bit of the healing, before finally this man, and we're told in verse 25 that he could see clearly now. And the word's quite, you know, he could see clearly from a distance. He could see everything. He could see clearly now. It's a very strange thing, it is, isn't it, to sort of think about. Why did Jesus need 2 attempts? So it's not that Jesus did something wrong. It's not that Jesus, you know, tried to heal him and it didn't quite work and then had to try again. Jesus was doing something there very, very special that he wanted to demonstrate. And it's going to link to what happens in the next few verses in a little bit. Now, when we think of someone being blind, what do you think that means? What's it mean to be blind? Any ideas? To not be able to see anything. We might call that complete blindness. Some of you might remember I used to be an optician, an optometrist. So I worked for a while in Manchester Eye Hospital. And quite a lot of the week we spent hours with people who were blind. And probably when it talks it here in the Bible, when they talk about blindness, they do literally mean they couldn't see a thing. That's what people meant by the word, especially in the past and so on. Nowadays we use the term a little more generally than that. We mention it in terms of someone who's got such poor eyesight, it's a disability, that kind of thing, really. So they could have some eyesight, which is what we're going to come to in a minute. So just for a minute, kid, and the grown-ups with them, put your hands over your eyes, and just imagine what life is like to not be able to see anything. To be, you know, you might as well not have any eyes at all, because there's no information at all, no nerves are working at the back of the eyes, no light is coming through. You know, they might as well not be there. Nothing's getting to your brain to tell it anything about the visual situation around you. Okay. And then, open your eyes again now. And then imagine what it's like then for there to be a bit of a gradual improvement. So you're not completely blind, as in you can't see anything, but what if you could just see a little bit? What if you could just see light? Here, if you share one for me, one for the moment, it's light. I don't think it's lit. So imagine for a minute, here's a bit of greaseproof paper, put that over your eyes. And now imagine and have a look what you can see there. So put a bit of greaseproof paper over your face. And now you see, you're getting something, aren't you? Pass them along so everyone can have a little go. You can see light, can't you? So if you look around the room with that over your eyes, you can see where the windows are. You can see the light of the window and then the dark in between, can't you? So you can see light and dark and just a bit generally like that. That might be the kind of situation somebody's in if they had a really, really bad cataract. You know, something like that, so their vision's really frosted over like that. So they can just see light and dark and things like that. So they're getting a little bit of information through. What about trying something else? This is a bit of a sort of plastic wallet. You might have for a minute. And again, now here's another one. Here's another one to try. Imagine what it's like to see like that. So now it's very fuzzy, but you can see a bit of colour, can't you? You see colours. And if you look towards me, if I move, you can see I'm moving, can't you? You can see the coloured patch that makes up my shirt. You can see something's there, can't you? Now I wonder if that's a little bit like what the man experienced when he says, I can see people, they look like trees, but they're walking. Maybe it's something a bit like that that you've got at the minute. So you can see a bit of colour, a bit of shape, and you can see movement. That's another sort of thing that you might be able to sort of pick up on. But it's all a bit of a jumble. Perhaps that's a little bit what this man experienced. He gets to that sort of stage where everything's just really blurry. He can see blobs and shapes. He can see there's something there, but he doesn't know if it's a man or a tree, really. He can see something moving there in front of him, but, you know, it's all a bit of a muddle, all a bit of a guess. And then, of course, go back to normal, back to your normal vision. You can see much more clearly. You can see shapes, you know, definitely. You can see how many fingers I'm holding up, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, you might get out a letter chart in an eye test and something like that. And so there's different sort of improvements you could look at in trying to go from seeing nothing to just sort of gradually thinking what those little steps could be in seeing a little bit more. One more thing to try, just for fun, try one of these. When I was at the eye hospital, while I was training, we had to spend a day at university with one of those situations. They make us a mask, and I had one that was a bit like the wallet. And so you had a pair of glasses that were made up like that, went right around your face, and you had to spend a couple of hours seeing what it was like to be visually impaired. And you had to go out with some friends who are hopefully going to help you cross a road. I'm not entirely sure if it's allowed these days just to launch somebody out in the deep end like that. So they put this over your face and now try and cross a road. In Manchester this was. To try and experience what it was like. It's interesting just to think, isn't it? Anyway, so these ones now, this little card you've got here, it's got a tiny little hole in it. So if you put that hole, and you have to manoeuvre it a little bit to get it right in front of your eye, and if you look through the little hole, you can actually see fairly clearly. But imagine if you could just see through that little hole and then try and walk around. You're having to sort of look around like this because you can only see a tiny bit at one time. Again, that might sort of introduce another idea. What if you can see, but you can only see one bit clearly, looking through a hole, and everything else is a bit of a blur and a bit of a muddle? And so this is what happens in this miracle. Jesus heals this man who's blind, and then he can see something, but he can't see everything. And then Jesus again performs a second miracle, and then he can see clearly. And what we're going to look at in a little while is how that actually makes a bit of sense in what's going to happen next. And it makes a bit of sense when we're thinking about what we can see in what do we understand about Jesus. And in that kind of way. You know the song Amazing Grace? And in it has the line, I was blind, but now I see. But for most of us who are Christians, perhaps actually, looking back, we might say, I was blind, and then I could see a bit. And then I could see a bit more. And gradually I'm learning to see, perhaps. And for most of us as Christians, perhaps it isn't quite, I was blind, and then I could see. But actually, perhaps it was, we went through some steps, and we could see things, but there were still things we couldn't. And gradually our sight improved. Perhaps those sort of levels of sight improvement and things like that. And that's what we're going to discover in a little minute of the situation the disciples were in. And perhaps that will help us sort of make sense of ourselves as well and other people. It might help us to get a bit of perspective on that, to recognise that actually maybe it wasn't quite as clear-cut as I was blind and now I see everything. But actually, there was a gradual process in that. And maybe as well, there's still some things I don't quite see yet. And we'll come back to that in a minute. After the strange healing of this man from his blindness, Jesus is on the road with his disciples. And Jesus asks his disciples a question. Who do men say that I am? And that might sort of be our first question. You know, thinking, what can we see? And can you see who Jesus is? That's what Jesus wanted to ask the disciples. He asked, first of all, what do you think other people see? What do the men, what do the crowds see? When they looked at Jesus and saw the things that he did, what did people see? What did people understand of the Lord Jesus? Just as an aside, it's interesting that Jesus is here. He's on the road to Caesarea Philippi. That was towards the coast back again, back towards sort of Gentile areas. And Jesus just gives us that little snippet there of something we're told in the Old Testament to use those opportunities when you walk along the road. Talk when you sit down for a meal. And so it's a reminder for us to take those opportunities to talk to people, to talk to people in our families, to talk to our children and so on. You know, to use those opportunities as Jesus did here. It's just as they're walking along the road. They're talking through these things. So Jesus says to the disciples, who do people say that I am? And there's a couple of different answers that the disciples have heard people saying. There's a couple of different things that have come up. Perhaps they've overheard people saying, and the gossip in the crowds and things like that. Some people said that Jesus was John the Baptist. Some people said he was Elijah, or one of the prophets who's been resurrected. And this was sort of a big idea of theirs. It's there in the Old Testament, this idea that Elijah would come first before the Messiah did. It's a little bit of a sort of cryptic sounding sort of reference. And so some people were literally expecting Elijah to come back from the dead and to come and go around and things. So perhaps some people are thinking, oh, is this chap, Jesus, is he actually Elijah who's come back from the dead? Or perhaps one of the other prophets. And the John the Baptist reference is a bit weirder because, of course, Jesus and John the Baptist were both there at the same time in the early part, of course, of Jesus' life. And so it wasn't like that they thought that Jesus was the same as John the Baptist, because there was obviously two individuals. But then John the Baptist did get put to death. And so perhaps some people who hadn't heard the whole story wondered if this new chap, Jesus, was John the Baptist come back. Anyway, it was all a bit of a muddle, wasn't it? What can you see? What could the crowd see of Jesus? What did they understand? And, give them some credit. They'd seen some things, hadn't they? They'd seen Jesus' miracles. They'd heard Jesus talking. And they have a level of sight that begins to dawn on them, we might say. It's quite different, of course, to the Pharisees, who we were thinking about last week, in the verses that come before. They see something very different, don't they? Or they can't see much at all. They hear these things of Jesus, they see his miracles, and all they can see, kind of clouded by their own anger and their own sort of judgmental sort of attitude of things, is that Jesus can't be who he says he is, and there must be something going on with this chap, and he maybe is a false teacher and all these things. He's got to give us a sign from heaven, all these things we've looked at in previous weeks. So the Pharisees could see virtually nothing, could they? They saw Jesus, and all they began to think was, he's an imposter, he's a false teacher, he doesn't quite toe the line with what we think, and so on. That was them. But the crowd, they see miracles, and they hear teaching, and they think, this man must be a prophet at least. He must be somebody special who's been sent by God, because he's got these amazing abilities to do things and this way of teaching us what God would have us know. So they begin to think a bit more, and they begin to see a bit more. But still, it's a bit of a muddle. To these crowds, it is just Jesus, the miracle worker. It's just Jesus, the religious teacher, and so on. That's as much as they can see at this time. So then Jesus then turns to the disciples and says to them, as Eliot read, verse 29, but who do you say that I am? What about you? You've said what the crowd think. Great. But what do you see? What do you understand about me? Jesus says to his disciples. And Peter is ready with his answer. You are the Christ. You are the Christ, Peter says. And the word Christ, that means the Messiah. It was sort of an interchangeable word. And Messiah was sort of the Hebrew word, if you like, Christ was sort of the Greek equivalent, that kind of thing. So those sort of equivalent words. And it sort of meant behind it the promised one, the anointed one, the chosen one. God's special one he sent, the Messiah. That's what Peter says. And that's what Peter can see. And Jesus picks up that kind of language in Matthew's account of this. In Matthew's account, Jesus commends Peter and says, these things have been revealed to you by God. God's the one who's enabled you to see this, even if the crowd couldn't yet. But God's helped you to see this, Peter, to see that I am the Christ, the Messiah. Again, in Peter's version, he goes one more statement. He says, you are the Son of God, Son of the living God, is what he says as well. Now, Peter could see. The penny had dropped in Peter's mind. He could begin to understand. He could see the same things that the Pharisees saw, the same things as the crowd saw, but helped by God, he could understand more than that. He could get it a bit deeper than the crowd did and the others did, and so on. He said, I can see this means that you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. So not just one of the prophets generically, like the crowd are saying. Not just one of them, but the one, the chosen one who had come from God, God's own son, his son whom he sent into this world. And no, that's a massive step that Peter took at this point. It's kind of where Mark has been leading all along. And that's kind of the structure of Mark's gospel. Mark started in chapter 1, verse 1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. That's the words that Peter said, wasn't it? But Mark launches us at the beginning of Mark's gospel with chapter 1, verse 1, saying that, just putting it out there, this is what it is. And then Mark gives us 8 chapters of evidence to show how Peter comes to exactly that same point. Who is this Jesus? And then that could be the question that's hanging over the whole first 8 chapters. Who is this Jesus? Can you see who he is? And all these bits of evidence stacking one upon the other, presenting this picture, and finally, for Peter, the penny drops. I can see it. You're the Christ, the Son of God. And that's a massive step for Peter to come to. No mean feat, because actually the situation in which Peter lives, there was also things stacked against him in that sense. Jesus was not very popular by this point. It seems, if you sort of read the Gospels together, perhaps especially if you look in John, that the feeding of the 5,000 was perhaps the high point of Jesus' popularity. And we're told in John's Gospel after that that people seem to steadily leave him. And so, of course, we did the feeding of the 5,000 a few months ago when we were in chapter 6. So this is after Jesus' popularity has begun to wane a bit. And there's actually fewer people following him now. He is still a penniless carpenter who's going around the towns of Galilee and the like. And there was distinctly earlier on in Mark the fact that these towns of Galilee also reject him, rather. Hence, in the last couple of chapters, we've seen Jesus going out to Tyre and Sidon, then round to Decapolis, and now he's off to Caesarea Philippi. He's actually going around sort of further out than the towns of Galilee because they've all rejected him. And so that's the kind of situation that's going on here. Jesus is opposed by the religious leaders. Even his own hometown have turned against him. And so Peter, you know, can see it. And you've got to give him credit for what he could see. You know, he's bold. He understands these things. He's tried to listen and to learn from Jesus. He's been the one, more than anyone, who seems to be closest to Jesus, hanging on his every word. And then helped by God, helped by the Holy Spirit, now he begins to see. It's revealed to him. He understands who Jesus is. And that's what's going to happen in the next chapter. In chapter 9, they're going to see something now of Jesus transfigured. He's going to look like the Christ, like the Messiah, like the Son of God, just for an instant up there on a mountain. And he's going to be transformed. He's going to be radiant. He's going to be shining with God's glory. That only happens in chapter 9 after they've had the eyes of faith to see it already in chapter 8. But anyway, there's Peter. There's the other disciples. It seems as well, reading from the other bits, that the other disciples join in with this as well. It's all of their confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And so that's the first step. What can you see? Thinking of our eye test with Jesus. Have you come to see that? That's our question for each of us this morning. Who do you say that I am? That's the question Jesus echoes out from this passage to each one of us. What do you understand of Jesus? As you've looked at the evidence, as you've read here in these last chapters we've been going through, as from other things you've read in the Bible, what do you understand about Jesus? Are you like the Pharisees? Are you like the crowd? Are you like Peter? What do you see? What do you understand? What's your confession? What is it that you're prepared to stand up and say, I know this, I can see this about Jesus? Thinking back to the blind man, and actually of other blind men who met Jesus in the Bible. And do you remember the one who's in the town of Jericho? This one's probably the last one, really, because it seems like it's right just before the last week of Jesus' life. And there's a man who calls out to Jesus who's blind. And he shouts and he shouts, Lord, I want to see. He keeps shouting it in the crowd until Jesus does it. If perhaps this morning you think to yourself, well, I don't really have a clue. All these things, I've heard bits and bobs about Jesus, I've come to church and this, that and the other, but I don't really know. I don't really know. I don't really understand who Jesus is. Maybe you can see, perhaps, no pun intended, that actually you can't see much. And then you need to be like that blind man. Cry out, Lord, I want to see. Is that your prayer this morning? Perhaps if you're in a muddle and you don't really know if you're a Christian or not, and you don't really know what you believe in this, that and the other. Is that your prayer? Lord, I want to see. Help me see something of the Lord Jesus Christ. So that's step one in our little eye test. We'll look at the next bit in just a moment. Let's pause. Jesus says to Peter, get behind me, Satan, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. It's strange, isn't it, how Peter could see so much and so little at the same time, isn't it? Peter says one thing, I can see you're the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus says, that's revealed to you by my Father. Next thing Peter says is, Jesus, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. These things are never going to happen to you. And Jesus says to him, you're saying now the things of Satan. That's what was going on in Peter. He can say one thing revealed by God, and the next minute he can say something that's being used by Satan. And Jesus does say this pretty strong language to Peter. Get behind me, Satan. That's probably one of the most sort of strongest statements that Jesus ever says. That's partly because it was the words of Satan coming through Peter to tempt Jesus. It was the very thing that Jesus was tempted with back in chapter 1 of Mark, when Satan tried to tempt Jesus from the path that was laid before him and said all kinds of other things. You bow down and I'll give you the glory of the kingdoms. You jump off the temple roof and so on. You know, when Satan tempted Jesus in those kind of ways, he was attempting Jesus to turn away from the road that God had laid out for Jesus to walk down. And Peter now is doing the same thing. He's trying to turn Jesus off the path that was laid before him. And so Jesus has to resist it, and he has to come down hard on Peter to tell him to stop. Get behind me, Satan. No more of that talk, because it was a temptation for him. And Jesus here renounces that temptation, carries on, and again, sort of linking to what's going to happen in chapter 9, as Jesus is transfigured there on the mountain and God's going to speak from heaven, this is my son, this is my beloved son. Because Jesus is the one who's steadfastly carrying on. He won't turn away from this path, and he's carrying on in it. But it's a strange thing, isn't it, as we look at Peter. Isn't Peter a daft mix of faith and foolishness, all bound up together? Peter can have these words of such astonishing perception. He could see, and he's brave enough to stand up and say it. I know that you are the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. And yet, in the next couple of minutes, he can say the most foolish thing. And then two things that don't match at all, do they? You can't say 1 minute to Jesus, you're the Son of God, and the next minute, and you're wrong. Those two things don't link, do they? They're inconsistent. But there's Peter, a mix of faith and foolishness. And it was difficult for them, but we shouldn't be too hard on Peter. There were those prophecies there in the Old Testament, weren't there, of the Messiah who was going to come. And it is a bit confusing sometimes. You seem to get some passages, like Isaiah 53, that predict the Messiah who would come and suffer. And yet there's other passages that seem to have a Messiah coming who's victorious and who reigns. And so perhaps it is difficult to try and piece all those things together for these people living in their generation, of course, as Jesus came. Perhaps it was understandable for Peter to be thinking of just one track of what the Messiah would do and sort of shunt the other things to the side. But there's truth in it, isn't there, for us as well? Aren't you and I a daft mix of faith and foolishness all in one go? And some things we can see as even as Christians, and some things we can't. Well, like looking through that little pinhole, you can try one out in a minute, and you can see in the distance clearly, but if you try walking there, you're going to fall flat on your face, because you can't see other things that are right in front of you. You've got huge blind areas at the same time. And that's the case, isn't it, for us as Christians? We're a mix, aren't we, of faith and foolishness too. And perhaps sometimes, you know, you can be in those kind of situations. You might be in a chat with chatting to a Christian or a non-Christian, and they just sort of say something to you, and it kind of just, you know, is there in your mind. And later on, you just think to yourself, well, was I right about that? Or have I got that a bit muddled up? Am I a bit wrong on that or the other thing? It's a good question to ask, because you could be. It's very easy for us to be wrong on something or other. What's the answer to it? But to humbly listen to Jesus, isn't it? Do we humbly listen to Jesus? What was really wrong, you see, with Peter was not that he had a wrong idea in his head, but the wrong thing was that he wasn't going to listen to Jesus to correct it, to have it corrected. That's the real way Peter went wrong, isn't it? And so for us, we may have some wrong ideas. We may have got the wrong idea out of the Bible. We may have muddled things up or taken something out of context or not really realised what God's saying to us. The biggest wrong move we can make is to not listen to Jesus. You and I are going to have hundreds of things wrong. Loads of blind spots in our understanding of what the Bible teaches and the Christian life and all these kind of things. But are we those who keep coming back to humbly listen? Who quite happily sit to Jesus and go, look, I don't understand this, and I think I might have got the wrong idea about this, but you teach me, show me what it is that I need to learn. Thinking back of that beggar, that blind beggar who called out to Jesus, Lord, I want to see. For those of us who are Christians, and we can say we can see some things, at least. Is it still our cry as we call out to the Lord Jesus, Lord, I want to see more. I want to see better. I want to see more clearly. Is that our petition for the Lord Jesus? Here, Jesus needs to teach Peter. This is important stuff. An essential thing that Peter is wrong about. It's essential. Jesus must suffer and be rejected and be killed and after 3 days rise again. We can be wrong on all sorts of things, but this thing is essential. that we get understood, that we get a grasp on. Why did Jesus have to die? Can you see it? Have you come to that understanding of it? Why did Jesus have to suffer, be killed, be rejected, and rise again? That's essential, to come to that understanding. You see, Peter knew a bit. He could see Jesus, a bit like the blind man who could suddenly see people, or were they trees, or they were walking. He could see a bit. And then Jesus had to do more healing, another miracle on him so he could see clearly. Peter could see a bit. He could see who Jesus was, but he couldn't understand why Jesus had to die. Do you understand that? That Jesus had to die. Otherwise, there's no forgiveness. Otherwise, there's no salvation. Otherwise, there is no new birth. There is no hope of heaven. Can you see why Jesus had to die? And that's what Mark's going to tell us. The disciples couldn't see it yet. So Jesus is going to put in a lot more work to help guide them through and teach them again and again. He's going to repeat it end of chapter 9. He's going to say exactly the same thing to them again. And Jesus is going to carry on teaching them this. And that's what Mark's going to do for the rest of the gospel. Teach us this next thing we need to understand. And so on. Lastly then, I think this is all just appearing in one go for some reason. But there we go. One other question. So we're only just going to introduce it because we're going to have to come back to it next week. A third question then. Can you see how Jesus wants you to live? And that's where Jesus moves next in his teaching. And the one comes straight after the other. And then this bit that Innie read for us, it's so much packed into it that we're going to have to come back to it next week. There's too much there. But I did want to just follow through the train of thought why Jesus goes there. In the next verse, verse 34. So Jesus called the people to himself with the disciples and said, "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Can you see how Jesus wants you to live? You see, Peter in his interruption of Jesus, verse 32, Peter instinctively thought, we could call it, of cross avoidance. Jesus says, "I'm going to suffer." And almost like a pantomime, Peter says, "Oh, no, you're not." "I'm going to be killed." "Oh, no, no, you're not." "I'm going to rise again." "Oh, no, you're not." That's Peter's interruption straight away, almost like he's in a pantomime. But there's another thing linked to it. Jesus says, "I'm going to suffer." Peter says, "Oh, no, you're not." And Jesus is going to say in these next few verses, "You need to be prepared to suffer too." And perhaps Peter's instinctive thought was, "Oh, no, I'm not." It wasn't just about Jesus in that sense as well, of Jesus going to the cross. But here Jesus starts to talk about that his followers need to take up their cross and follow him. And Peter would instinctively have balked at that idea as well. To follow Jesus, to mean taking up our cross. And so that's where Jesus moves in the next topic. That's again one of those things we need to understand, isn't it? To become a Christian, we need to understand who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. And then carrying on as a Christian, we need to understand, how do we follow him? How do we live? How do we carry on as a Christian? And here, just a couple of little things. Jesus says, "You've got to follow me through thick and thin. You've got to take up your cross." So we'll look more at it next week. It's not a cross like Jesus did. It's not a cross to save people. Only Jesus could do that. And sometimes people boil it down the opposite way, and people will say all kinds of things, don't you? You meet someone and they might have arthritis, and they say, "Oh, that's my cross to bear." Or they might be unemployed and they say, "Oh, that's my cross to bear." That's not at all what Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about those generic things and so on like that. But he's talking about coming after me. Let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. It's those steps that we take as a Christian to surrender ourselves to Jesus and to obey him in everything, in every footstep we're going to make as we go after him, following him obediently. And Jesus here warns that's going to be hard and that's going to be costly and that's going to involve suffering and difficulty. But you see, it links to those things that came before. Because we can be blind to who Jesus is, We can be blind to what Jesus has done. And even as Christians, we can still have a large measure of blindness in not knowing how to follow him, really. And one of those things we have is a blind spot, perhaps. Perhaps especially in our age, in our generation, is we try and pick the most comfortable option, don't we? That's what we do. You go to DFS, you pick the most comfortable sofa to sit on. You go to a car showroom and you pick the most comfortable car to sit. You know, we pick comfort all the time. That's the world in which we live. We can't get away from it. But sometimes perhaps that ends up being our blind spot as Christians in this century that we live in, that we find it very hard. We have a blind spot, just like Peter did. We think of cross avoidance. We think of how to avoid suffering, how to avoid hardship. Normally is cutting back on obedience and cutting back on being like Christ. But here Jesus links these things together. That's one thing we need to ask as well, isn't it? Like that blind man, Lord, I want to see. Is that our cry as we call out to God? Lord, I want to see more of how you'd have me live, how you'd have me follow Jesus. So that's just introducing that last idea. We'll look more at that next week in these wonderful verses that Jesus is going to go on to explain there. But that's our desire this morning, isn't it? To challenge that those blind spots that we can have. Do you know who Jesus is? Do you know what Jesus came to do and why? Have you made that confession, like Peter, that you're the Son of God? And you know why he died? Why he died for you? And are we seeking as Christians to follow him?